The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Books Podcast with me, Claire Armitstead. On this week's show, we dip into the Edinburgh International Book Festival, where to start with a literary shindig involving 1,000 speakers from 50 countries. This year's headliners included Paul Auster, Zadie Smith, Caroline Duffy, and Chris Hoy, who thrillingly for We Cycle Nuts has channeled his sporting prowess into a picture book series for kids. But we decided to nab Booker nominee Colson Whitehead, who had just flown in from the US to discuss his alternative history of slavery, the Underground Railroad, and Norwegian author Lars Mutting to talk about his turn from woodpiles to war stories. We also talked to Rachel Seifert about being on the wrong side of history and listen in to two rising stars from the world of spoken word poetry. But first, while I've been out and about, Sian Kane has been chained to her desk all summer. Well, someone has to do it. Apart from one week of rather excitingly sea kayaking.
So yeah, that was pretty good.
We thought we'd have a catch up on all our summer reading. What have you been up to, Sian?
Well, about 10 years after everyone else, I finally read Golden Hill by Frances Bufford, which I know you really liked as well. And it's an absolute corking novel. And
historical.
Yeah.
18th century.
Well, I had it described to me as someone attempting to write a Henry James novel now.
It's almost Dumas
or something, you know. It has that spirit in it.
Lots of swashbuckle.
Yeah, and it's absolutely wonderful. I really, really loved it. So I'd absolutely recommend that to everyone. I also read a bit of Helen Garner, and if anyone doesn't know Helen Garner, you should, because she's massively underappreciated.
Australian writer.
Yeah, Australian sort of essayist and journalist, and she's written a lot of books that seem to revolve around court cases in Australia, but they're always massively interesting. And the one I read in particular was called The First Stone, which is from the 90s, which revolves around a sexual harassment case in an Australian university in 1993. It's really fantastic, and she sort of approaches it with sort of a bit of gender studies in her mind, but also looking at sort of things like these educational institutions that have sort of years of patriarchy built into them, and how do you navigate that when you have this sort of new wave of feminism that was coming up in the 90s. Her position as an older feminist, looking at these young girls that were making these claims, how does she feel and how does she relate to them? Because, like, you know, she talked to her friends and they'd all be like, oh, well, we had much worse back when we were in our 20s, and why are they complaining? And it sort of seems like she has to examine that way of thinking, you know, is that the way to think about things? So that was fantastic. And she's got a new book coming out in September, actually, over here. It's already out in Australia. But she's got a new book of essays called Everywhere I Look. And I also finally read some Daphne du Maurier, who I've never read before.
And that was because of a piece in The Guardian about My Cousin Rachel, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that was fantastic. There was a fantastic piece in the review, Saturday Review, just about My Cousin Rachel, because there was a film recently. And I just went, oh, God, that premise sounds fantastic. So I went and blasted through that in a weekend. I just loved it. So went, if anyone lives in London, to Scoob Books and stocked up on some old Daphne du Maurier. And now I'm sort of powering my way through Rebecca.
So I have a completely different sort of summer because of the Edinburgh Festival. It's always a bit of a festival route march for me.
You have to read about 20 books.
I counted that I read 15 books in August. Ugh. Obviously the ones featured on this podcast, but also I have to put in a word for a really lovely Swiss novel by a writer called Roland Buti, who unfortunately doesn't speak English, so we couldn't have him on the podcast. And it's called The Year of the Drought, and it isn't actually out till early next month, set on a farm in the heat wave of 1976, which I remember well because I did my A-levels that summer. And everybody was fainting in school gyms across the UK, but obviously it was a big thing in France as well, and in Switzerland. And this couples a coming of age story of a 13-year-old boy with a tale of domestic and economic meltdown, and it's only 146 pages long, but it's fabulously concentrated.
Yeah.
And what seems at first like a fable is actually a masterclass in how to compress information.
Oh, fantastic! That sounds great.
But I've also been catching up with the spoken word poetry scene because I think there's something really interesting going on there. Do you agree?
Yeah, well, poetry is sort of one of these things that it's really risen in sort of the public consciousness, I think. And we actually did a news piece about it recently where we found that the sales of poetry books have gone up by more than 50% in the last 4 years and 12% in the last year alone, which is quite remarkable. And we've sort of been talking about whether that rise is driven by this new generation of performance poets, because we're seeing a lot of young performance poets getting a lot of press attention. So people like Kate Tempest, obviously, but there's people like the Young People's Laureate Caleb Femi, Kaya Chigonyi, who we had on the podcast 2 weeks ago.
And I went to see quite a few events involving young women.
You said they were rude.
They are so rude, as you will hear. Anybody who is brave enough to listen in towards the end of the podcast will hear two sessions, and they're dealing with all sorts of things around sexual politics.
Is it just because
really impressive?
Is it this sort of compensatory rudeness, sort of catching up for the lost dialogue that, you know, previous generations of female poets haven't had? They haven't been able to get up on stage and talk about menstruation and stuff like that.
Yeah, menstruation. There's a very good poet called Sabrina Mahfouz who's done this book of monologues by four prostitutes in London.
Wow.
Jemima Foxtrot, who talks about being a dyke in so many words. Really impressive. Lot of dames. We'll be hearing from a couple of them later, Holly McNish and the New Zealander Hera Lindsay Bird. But first, I met up with Colson Whitehead. Whitehead's written six novels, but it's his latest, The Underground Railroad, that has caught everyone by surprise, winning the Pulitzer Prize, the Arthur C. Clarke Award, and being longlisted for the Booker Prize. I met him and asked him if he was surprised by the reaction.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I was just doing my usual thing, you know, trying to do the best I can with each book, and then I realized when I handed it into my editor and wife, they're very supportive, but in a different way than they had been in the past. And I sort of knew that I had done something different.
And how did you come up with this thing of mixing fantasy and history? You've done both before. You've done a zombie novel, Zone One. You've done historical fiction. And suddenly here it is in a sort of fusion novel.
You pick the right tool for the job. And so the original conception was that the railroad would be real. So the fantasy part is built in at the very beginning. Each state being an alternative America was an early decision. And so from the very start, it was not going to be a straightforward historical novel. I don't feel any need. I'm not in some historical novelist guild where I have to obey the rules. And so I can mix and match different tools to get the work done.
The Underground Railroad is you've made literal something that did happen, but it was a network, and you've made it into actually a railroad.
Sure, it was a network of people who helped slaves escape from the South to the free North, and, you know, maybe hide them in the wagon, take them 100 miles, hand them off to someone else, hide them until the coast was clear. But when kids first hear about it, I'm not the only one, they envision a literal subway beneath the earth because it's so evocative. And so I was sitting on my couch now 17 years ago and thought, oh, wouldn't it be weird, just a weird idea for a book if it was a literal network. And so really this comes from exploring this childish idea of what it actually was.
I would be very interested to hear you summarize it. I've heard lots of other people summarizing it. I have my own summary, but how would you summarize this novel?
Well, it's a story of a slave named Cora. She's around 17 years old, and she hears of the Underground Railroad, decides to leave her plantation with another comrade. It starts off very realistic and then becomes a novel with fantastic flourishes as each different state she goes through, South Carolina, North Carolina, provides a different portrait of America, an alternative America. So there's a black utopia state, there's a white supremacist state, sort of like Gulliver's Travels. And as she goes from becoming an object, a piece of property, into a person, we see her grow into this new role.
America's obviously in quite a turbulent situation at the moment, in terms of leadership, in terms of race relations, in recent events. What does this novel have to offer this period? Why now?
Yeah, it's not for me to say what it offers. But if you write about white supremacy in 1850, where the book takes place, you end up writing about white supremacy now, because all the sort of dark energies that drove so much of the forming of America are still in play. And so if you look at someone like Trump, who embodies some of the worst impulses in the American psyche, you see how that sort of darkness is submerged for a while. We can forget about it, but it's always there waiting to return, because it's very part of the foundation of the country.
And then the final question is the G question, the genre question. There have been huge debates around genre and the respectability of it. Tell me what your take on it is, particularly on science fiction, fantasy. Do you think that people don't take it as seriously as it should be taken still?
Yeah, I mean, we're having this question now, so we're talking about it right now, so that's true. For me, I grew up reading science fiction and fantasy, and that's what made me want to become a writer. And I've written books that are realistic, books that are more fantastic, and you really just choose the right storytelling device for the story you want to get across, and that seems very simple to me. And if you look at the careers of, say, in America, Toni Morrison, Philip Roth, they've used fantasy. There's a ghost in Beloved. The Plot Against America by Philip Roth is an alternative history. And so, you write a bunch of books and you try different ways of talking about the world. So it seems very natural to me, even if it seems bizarre to other people.
And some people have used the word magical realism, but there is a difference between magical realism and fantasy, isn't there? Would you use that word in connection with it?
I'd say fantasy. For me, science fiction, allegory, magic realism, they're all just forms of fantasy, so I don't really make distinctions. I realize that as human beings, we have to find different definitions of words in order to have a common language. So what you want to call how I use fantasy in the book doesn't really bother me. For me, it's all the same thing.
And the last final question is, you're here in Scotland, you've been touring around the States, you are now going off to Scandinavia. Is there a different reception in different countries or different areas of America for it?
Not so much in America. I mean, I think there are places like Tucson in Arizona and New Hampshire in America where there's a very low black population. I tend to show up and I just get sort of asked a random black guy a question instead of talking about the book. In terms of other countries, different countries have their relationship to slavery, and so Holland originated the slave trade and they are sort of in some ways grappling with that legacy, and so they had a different response. And then I think it's being translated in a lot of different countries, much more than my previous books. And I think that just that relationship between the dominators and the dominated, the oppressors and the oppressed, can translate to different cultures, whether it's royalty versus peasants, the rich against the poor. And so that power dynamic transcends its specific origins in American slavery.
It's won an Arthur C. Clarke Award, it's won a Pulitzer, and you're now up for the Booker. Were you surprised to get so much varied attention?
Yeah, I mean, it's my eighth book. I have two books of nonfiction. And really, I was just sort of trying to do my usual thing, and I've been very delighted and surprised by the reception. Of course, it's very life-changing, and it's great. And so despite my best efforts to be pessimistic and in a bad mood, I'm really quite cheerful these days.
That was Colson Whitehead. The Underground Railroad is published by Fleet. You're listening to the Guardian Books Podcast. One of the great things about festivals is that they bring you into contact with writers you don't know. I chaired a session with one writer I do know very well, Rachel Seifert, and one I had the pleasure of meeting for the first time, Lars Mutting. You may remember Mutting as the man who chopped and hacked his way into the consciousness of the reading world with Norwegian Wood, stacking and drying wood the Norwegian way. It became the comfort read of 2015, preempting and possibly inspiring the hygge craze of the following year. Well, he's also a novelist with two books to his name, and he's back with the first of them to be translated into English. It's called, surprise, surprise, The 16 Trees of the Somme, and it's a cracking read. I discovered Rachel Seifert back in 2001 when her first novel, The Darkroom, very nearly won the Guardian First Book Prize and was also on the shortlist of the Booker. It was a story of people on the wrong side of history, a theme she returns to in her fourth novel, A Boy in Winter, which is set in the Ukraine in 1941. I began by asking Rachel why she decided to set this new novel in the Ukraine.
It's a surprise to me as well, but I stumbled across a story of a German engineer who was in the Ukraine in order to escape the draft, to escape fighting in the war. He got himself stationed in the Ukraine in 1941 in order to build a road as part of the occupying forces. And I stumbled on his story while trying to write another book entirely, but the situation was irresistible to me. He is a man who has tried his best to avoid a war he considers criminal, and then he wakes up one November morning and sees out of his boarding house window that the SS have come to town and are rounding the Jews up. And that, to me, it's 3 days. It follows him and four other characters over the next 3 days in this fateful Ukrainian winter. And the situation was just irresistible. The moral questions it raised were just irresistible to me as a writer.
And my other guest is Lars Mutting. Tell me what your project is, Lars.
Well, it's a on the surface, it may look as a spider web of family mysteries. It traces a incident at the battlefields of the Somme in 1916 and shows how that incident affected three families throughout three generations. Obviously, it doesn't tell all these stories in full, but say what I call the spider web of the plot. On a more literary level, and perhaps the most interesting level for me as a writer, was to explore this through the narrative voice of a young man who's left with almost no relatives and is trying to find his way back through history and see what caused him to grow up as an orphan in Norway.
So with both these questions, the big question is, why did you decide to tell these particular stories? And in both cases, there are personal, very personal connections. Rachel, you are driven back and back again to investigate the question of complicity.
Absolutely. My I'm of German heritage. My grandparents were both members of the Nazi Party. And so for me, it's very personal, this question of involvement, of complicity, the shades of grey that lead people to be on the wrong side of history. And the legacy of that for me is that I just have to explore it in my writing. I read about it all the time, just as a reader, and then every so often there will just be a snippet of a person, an event, which then isn't actually necessarily covered by the historical record. So I will seek out witness testimonies, but there won't be enough, or it just won't be written about at all, and then my way of exploring it is to write fiction.
You made during the session a very interesting point about complicity and the fact that the mainland Europe, there are parts of Europe that were complicit in the Second World War in ways that we have never had to contend with, and it doesn't necessarily mean that we would make different decisions. Mm. And Lars, you also, Norway had a complicity.
Absolutely, and the before the war, for example, the connections between Norway and Germany were extremely good. They were, country very interested in our common culture and background. But of course, that through the dark pre-war years, that changed. But during the war, a lot of Norwegian young boys were faced with a choice of joining the Germans to fight against a possible Bolshevik regime. And that led about 5,000 boys to fight in German uniforms at the Eastern Front. I think the treatment of these boys and the choices that they had to face at a very young age has been a project of the Norwegian post-war understanding of ourselves. Many, many books and a lot of focus has been drawn to this, and I think it has matured in the later years into the big question on the difficulty of such a big choice.
Although your book is set in Norway, the Shetlands, interestingly, because you make the part of the point of it is this huge connection between Shetland and Norway, but also in the Somme. You part of your personal story is that you have a relative who it's buried in the very area of Ukraine that Rachel is writing about.
Yeah, that's the that's one of the a very distant relative of mine who's actually buried in the same marshes as Rachel's book is set. But the major part of the story is set in Shetland, and that's because in my story there are two brothers, one who's in German uniform and the other is leaving for Shetland to join the Allied side. He's a hopeless soldier, but he goes there anyway. And that's a way of me to reopen that link from the 1940s. I reopen that link when my main character goes there to find the truth about what happened.
And the story is the present in your story is 1991. Mm. And that's because actually it's passed out of living memory.
Yeah, it couldn't be said today because I needed to have witnesses of what happened in the wartime years. Simply someone that he can he can meet and be familiar with the incidents. But another character who is perhaps even more important in that narrative aspect is when he joins company with a young Shetland girl who is on the same quest as him to unveil what happened to her family in those years. And very soon they discover that these incidents are interconnected in a very unpleasant way.
So your story is almost like it uses the tropes of a thriller. It's got speedboats and guns and a sort of big mystery. But Rachel, yours is very much quieter. And I'm interested in how you decide what form a story is going to take. And we know with The Dark Room you decided to divide your stories into three, almost three novellas. And this one, it's very fluid the way you move between the different characters who have very different experiences.
Yes, I thought for me, at first, I mean, I thought when I came across this story of this engineer who faced a moral dilemma, I thought the time frame, the limiting the time frame for the narrative was the best idea, because then you have you are forced into making a choice one way or another, even if your choice is not to act, and there is no escaping a moral choice of one kind or another, whether it is cowardice or bravery or somewhere in between, and most choices end up falling in between those stools. So the warning of seeing the Jews being rounded up was definitely had to be the start of the book. And then the more I read about these incidents, all proceeded in a very similar form across the Ukraine that winter. 3 days was the sort of average time span that it took for the Germans to complete, the SS to complete their operations in any given district. So 3 days then seemed to me to be also just to contain the tension and enable enough crossing over between my characters and enough of those stories and enough of those moral dilemmas, because everybody, all of my characters face them, not just the German, but all the Ukrainians and the Jews as well who come up in the book. They all face choices they have to make under time pressure without knowing enough about the consequences of their action in order to feel safe at any given moment.
Now, these are both, in a sense, historical novels, but they're very resonant, aren't they? And this is a point that you made, Rachel. Just tell us a little bit about what the resonance, why should we be listening to these stories now? As you say, Lars, you know, the last witnesses are dead now. What is the resonance?
Well, I think it's important to look at how incidents in our past generation will still affect us, and how some either heroism or fallacies or wrongdoings may still go on in the next generations. Perhaps not that you continue in the same path. I don't believe in such a thing, but I believe that there is a certain pressure on the past generation that somehow puts its mark on the next, either we like it or not, and either we understand it or not. So I think simply to go into the depths of that and explore it is not a duty, but a healthy exercise for us to understand also the pattern, perhaps, over our own what we would do when we face a situation that's difficult, because we will never face a completely similar situation. We cannot learn one-to-one from history. We have to say, put it in the back of our spine and be prepared. As you, Rachel, mentioned very brilliantly, that everyone thinks that they're the good guy and that they're doing the right thing, even when they're in the middle of evil.
No, absolutely. I mean, I agree with Lars that there is never an exact mapping. History never repeats itself exactly. But for me, there are, and certainly when I was researching, I came across the story of the engineer that was in 2016, and there were so many parallels with the 1930s going on in Europe and in America that I just couldn't not write about this man who seemed to me so much like so many of us who were stumbling around trying to do the right thing and not always succeeding. And particularly for British readers, I think, because we don't know in our bones compromise. in the same way that Europeans do. It's part of the European backbone, to use Lars's analogy, or part of the genetic makeup now of continental Europeans, because they were so compromised by the communists and then by the fascists. And on our little islands, we had the luxury of being in the right from start to finish.
And in both these cases, the marks are left on the landscape, aren't they? Because in your novel, Rachel, the Germans actually laid down the roads, which presumably is the basic transport infrastructure of Ukraine today. Mm. And in your case, Lars, there are places where bits of France that are still sacrosanct for the as war cemeteries.
Mm. Yeah, they still are. I was... On my research, I went to some of the forests in France where it's still really dangerous to enter. And during my research, two road workers were driven to hospital because they stepped on a gas grenade. Much of the same thing that happens in one of the subplots in my book. And the impression it makes on my main character, he's a farm boy. So has a very immediate connection to the soil and to the living things. So he's, I think a major part of, you know, his role or in the book is how he connects with the landscape, either at the barren Shetland Isles or at the marshy fields of the Somme or in the Norwegian forests. And I think there's a deeper connection there because he's able to look at, for example, the old forests and the trees as time witnesses to a lot of generation. A tree will outlive us, perhaps by many generations, and see our successes and failures.
And so we come back to wood, and I'm sure your many fans of Norwegian wood will be very glad to know that trees do play a very important part in this novel. Thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.
That was Rachel Seifert and Lars Mutting. The 16 Trees of the Somme is published in the UK by Maclehose Press, and A Boy in Winter is out from Virago. This is the Guardian Books podcast. As we said earlier, there's a lot going on at the moment in the world of spoken word poetry. I caught several sessions during my time at the festival and managed to smuggle a microphone into one by Holly McNish and Hera Lindsay Bird, two poets whose performances are attracting a fast-growing cohort of fans on YouTube and Twitter. McNish, you may remember, scooped the Ted Hughes Award this year for her dispatch from the front line of motherhood, Nobody Told Me, which we featured on the podcast early last year. She's back with a raunchy new collection, Plum. Hera Lindsay Bird was part of a lively New Zealand delegation whose debut has been the fastest-selling, most popular book of poetry ever published in her native country. First, we hear from Holly, then from Hera. And a word of warning, if you're easily offended, this may not be for you.
Yes, I'm going to read some poems for you. I hope you enjoy them. It's really lovely to be here. Yeah, I'm just going to read a few from this book, and it's a new book that I got out about a month ago, and it's a collection, I guess, from of poems that I wrote from the age of about 8 up to 33, and most of them are looking back, but it's also got some of the like terrible poems I wrote when I was actually a teenager in it as well. And this first one is a poem that is written about being 14, but my mum's asked me to say that it's about being 16 because she doesn't think it's a very good thing to read out to people and say that it was that age, but it's definitely not. It's from the age of 14. And it's one when, I don't really know how to say this politely at the literature festival, so I just won't, but it's one about one of my friends who asked not to be named, but it works better, I think, if I name her. I promise I won't put it in the book, but I'll say her name every time I read it out. But yeah, she was the first person that had a proper boyfriend that she wanted to give a hand job to, I guess is how I'd put it. And she asked us all for advice because she didn't know how to do it. And we'd read somewhere that you go up and down. And so we all gave our brilliant 14-year-old advice. And she tried it, and the guy, Josh, ended up in hospital. Oh yeah. Anyway, so this is about that, and it's called Yanking. Apparently, up and down did not mean like a lever. Like a door handle. like a joystick, like a casino slot machine. It meant up and down, fingers curved around, gentle strokes from shaft to tip. We only learned this after Rowena had tried the alternative yanking motion and almost snapped her boyfriend's dick. We gathered, listened, stroked her back, our impulse perfume shirts. We stroked her back in hidden prayer. Thank fuck, she did it first.
Alright, so the first poem I'm going to read to you tonight is one from my book, Hera Lindsey Bird, and it is called Children Are the Orgasm of the World. Don't be nervous, it's fine. Children are the orgasm of the world. This morning on the bus, there was a woman carrying a bag with inspirational sayings and positive affirmations on it, which I was reading because I'm a fan of inspirational sayings and positive affirmations. I also like clothing that gives you advice. What's better than the glittered baseball cap of a stranger telling you what to strive for? It's like living in a world of therapists. The inspirational bag of the woman on the bus said a number of things like live in the moment and remember to breathe. But it also said, children are the orgasm of the world. Are children the orgasm of the world like orgasms are the orgasms of sex? Are children the orgasm of anything? Children are the orgasm of the world like hovercraft are the orgasm of the future, or silence is the orgasm of the telephone, or shit is the orgasm of the lasagna. You could even say that sheep are the orgasm of modern farming practices, which are the orgasm of the Industrial Revolution. And then I thought, why not? I like comparing things to other things too. Like sometimes when we're having sex and you look like a helicopter in a low-budget movie disappearing behind a cloud to explode. Or an athlete winning a prestigious sporting tournament at the exact same moment he realises his wife has been cheating on him. For the most part, orgasms are the orgasms of the world. Like slam dunking a glass basketball, or executing a perfect dive into a swimming pool full of oh my god, or travelling into the past to forgive yourself and creating a time paradox so complex it forces all of human history to reboot, stranding you naked on some rocky outcrop, looking up at the sunset from a world so new, looking up hasn't even been invented yet.
That was Hera Lindsey Bird and Holly McNish. Bird's eponymous poetry collection will be published in the UK by Penguin in November, and McNish's latest collection, Plum, is out now from Picador. And that's all from us for this week. You can join in the discussion on Twitter at Guardian Books or on the Guardian website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast, which is also how you'll find us in your favourite podcast app. Next week, we'll be listening into the fabulous Colm Toy Bean explaining his latest novel, House of Names, at a Guardian Live event. But for now, from me, Claire Armitstead,
and me, Sian Kane,
and our producer, Simon Barnard, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.